I don't know much about heaven, but hell I can show you on a map.
Ich kann Ihnen die Hölle auf einer Karte zeigen.
That is what the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt said about Sobibor.
On the 14th of October 1943, something happened in the Sobibor extermination camp, a secret camp in eastern Poland. Something that no one there had previously thought possible. Prisoners, fearing they would not survive the camp, rose up in revolt.
Let's fight back, we will die anyway.
They take up arms that day. The goal is a mass escape.
Let's fight back.
They killed some of the German camp guards.
I went in and I jabbed them with a knife and we killed them.
The uprising is discovered earlier than intended. They have to be quick.
I started running. I wasn't far away from that opening they made in the fences.
The prisoners run out of the camp, over the barbed wire, straight into a minefield.
The machine guns were up top in the towers. And then the shooting started.
Dozens of prisoners are killed and only a small group reaches the edge of the forest. They flee with the courage of despair.
Even when one will survive of that nearly 500 people, the escape is going to be a success.
A small group survives the uprising and the war. They can tell what happened in Sobibor. During the Second World War, there would be no more successful uprisings in SS camps in which so many guards were killed. The story of Sobibor as an extermination camp is unique, but it's also unimaginable. Almost everyone who arrived at this secret camp was sent to the gas chambers on the same day. And as bitter as it may be, most people today still know very little about what happened there. Sobibor is not a well-known name, at least not as well-known as Auschwitz.
Those gas chambers were demolished during the war. Sobibor was a bizarre death machine where more than 170,000 people were murdered. How could such an insane place come into being? How could this happen? The first thing victims of Sobibor saw upon arrival were charming German cottages with flower boxes, signposts with swimming pool on them. Of course, there was no swimming pool at all there. You would almost think you were walking into a holiday park.
Sobibor ran on lies. Prisoners were deceived from the moment they arrived until the door of the gas chambers closed behind them. Those were the words of Jules Schelvis, the man who survived Sobibor and wrote several books about the camp. His statement makes it difficult to accept that there are still stories about this camp that are not entirely accurate or complete.
That, in just a few sentences, is why we made this series. This is The Silence of Sobibor, and you're listening to Episode 1, A Guilty Place. In this series, we want to explore the stories of this camp where so many people were murdered. That alone cannot be done without words. For example, the word prisoners. In this series, we use the word prisoner literally. Not the prisoner from our current constitutional state, but purely someone who is locked up, someone who is being held in a camp behind barbed wire and fences. Poet Ida Gerhardt once said that no word could ever do justice to the crimes of war. Well, perhaps this word is one of them. But we will have to make do with it. We are podcast makers Patty Lou Middellane here and Richard Grootbot from Audiodrome Podcast Productions. And we're producing this series in collaboration with the Sobibor Foundation in the Netherlands.
Sobibor only existed for about a year and a half. In 1944, Soviet troops crossed the border and the Germans were pushed back further and further. A group of journalists followed the Soviet troops to document what had happened in recent years. They took photographs and spoke to residents of villages, including those in the region around Sobibor. However, after 1945, All this information was locked away on Stalin's orders. No one in the West ever saw it.
Surprisingly, however, more and more documents from the end of the war have been recently appearing on a Russian website, and we can now view a large part of those Soviet documents. In this podcast series, we will try to find out what those documents tell us.
That's quite a task, because there are hundreds of documents in Russian that we can now review. With the help of translation websites, we are slowly getting a rough idea of what those papers tell us. We read statements recorded in the summer of 1944, sometimes only a few days after the Soviet troops drove out the Germans.
And there are photographs. In one of them, we see double rows of barbed wire and a sign with text we cannot decipher. Is this a photograph of the Sobibor fence? And if so, when was this photograph taken? What do these documents from the Soviet archives tell us about the history of Sobibor? We will return to this in more detail later on.
But we want to start the story where it happened. We are driving through a forest full of pine trees in the easternmost part of Poland, close to the border with Ukraine and Belarus. The road to Sobibor is long, straight, a cobbled road. On the left, we occasionally see the railway tracks running between the trees. We are headed straight for the site of the extermination camp. After the uprising and the escape of a group of prisoners, almost everything was razed to the ground. The camp leadership wanted to destroy as much evidence of the existence of this place as possible, but they did not succeed.
When we arrive at Sobibor station, we see several train tracks. On one side, there are the tracks that are still used sparingly for regional trains transport. On the other side are the tracks that were used to transport prisoners during the war. These tracks are only visible here and there. Nettles, brambles, and even young trees grow between the sleepers. The tracks are almost completely overgrown. Further on, the trains stopped and everyone had to get out.
Archaeologists carried out excavations in the soil at Sobibor. Some of what they found is displayed in showcases in a museum further along the site. The story of Sobibor was buried in the ground. A team spent years conducting archaeological research. They found tens of thousands of objects. All kinds of things came to light, including house keys. Each key belonged to someone who came there thinking they would be able to return one day. But with a few exceptions, none of those people ever went home.
If you asked people about the lowest point of the Second World War, the answer would probably be Auschwitz, that place with that iconic gatehouse, the fence with Arbeit macht frei. But not many people know that it was in three camps in eastern Poland, Belzec, Treblinka and Sobibor, that mass murder using gas chambers took place on a large scale for the first time. Between 1.5 and 2 million people were murdered here. Yet, to this day, the names of these three camps are unfamiliar to many people. After the war, the former site of Sobibor became a forgotten place of the Holocaust. We read that it was used by local residents as a children's playground and a picnic spot. People dug for gold left behind by the victims. Yet, there were also people who realized that a memorial should be erected for all those who perished here.
More than 33,000 of those victims came from the Netherlands, and each story shows once again how horrific and insane Sobibor was.
Wij gingen samen naar school.
We went to school together. Richard Oostwal, 93 years old, tells a story about his neighbor. Sitting at his kitchen table, he shows us a photograph of a serious-looking boy of about 10 years old, wearing glasses. A photo taken during the war.
Hij had ook nog twee zusjes.
He talks about Robbie Slachter, the boy who lived across the street from him, a boy who also had two sisters.
Robbie was dezelfde leeftijd als ik, we schelen 4 maanden.
Richard and Robbie were the same age, and Robbie's mother took them to school. They lived across the street from each other in Amsterdam East, but one day, Robbie's house is suddenly empty.
Hij ging niet meer mee naar school. Is hij nooit meer teruggekomen?
After the holidays, Robbie was gone. Just like that, Richard says. Richard searches the entire neighborhood to find out where his friend has gone, until his parents tell him to stop looking and that Robbie has gone to a camp. A camp. What does a child think upon hearing that?
Heb ik nooit begrepen. Ik was kwaad op hem.
I was angry, says Richard. He was going away on a camp and didn't bother to say goodbye. Why? We were best mates. Years after the war, Richard goes in search of what happened to Robbie. In his school archives, he finds a list where he and Robbie are listed together in a class of no fewer than 46 children. The list also reveals something else. Robbie's name wasn't Robbie at all.
Hey, die heet Salomon. En ik had het steeds over Robbie.
Richard continues searching the archives to find out what had happened to his friend Robbie, or Salomon, as he is actually called. Salomon is a Jewish name. What Richard didn't realize as a child was that during the war, families in his neighborhood often disappeared suddenly, just like Robbie's. His parents explained to him that this was because they were Jewish. That's why Robbie and his family had to be transported to a labor camp, Richard was told.
After receiving information from the school, Richard decides to continue searching for the fate of Robbie's extended family.
De stamboom van de familie heb ik uitgezocht.
In his search, he discovered that Robbie came from a large family and that almost all of them were murdered in Sobibor.
Information from the archives that Richard can access show that Robbie, along with 2,510 other people, was transported by train in May 1943. The train stopped in a small town in eastern Poland, where everybody was taken off and brought straight to the gas chambers. In one single day, everybody on the train was gassed and their bodies burned. After that, Camp Sobibor was ready for the next train from the Netherlands. Sobibor was a machine, a non-stop death row.
Richard decides he wants to commemorate his old school friend and that he wants to keep telling people what happened to Robbie. It becomes a kind of a life mission for him. Together with us, he wants to go to the place where Robbie was murdered, Sobibor. What image do you have of a place where so many people were gassed?
Er is veel geschreven over die naargeestige afgelegen plek.
Much has been written about that gloomy, remote place hidden in the forest of eastern Poland, Sobibor.
Christine Gispen-de-Wietz is the chairperson of the Sobibor Foundation in the Netherlands. We're joining a memorial trip organized by the foundation. We're in a bus with Richard, relatives of victims, people who want to commemorate family members who were murdered in the camps, and members of the foundations who are accompanying the trip. Incidentally, if you have never been there, don't imagine it to be a place like Auschwitz. In Sobibor, every building has disappeared, demolished. The road that prisoners had to walk can be seen. The foundations of the gas chamber have been found. And there is a museum.
Overlevende Esther Raap zei toen ik haar interviewde.
Survivor Esther Raap said, when I interviewed her, the essence of the camp was fear. People were killed at random. No one knew who would be next, where it would be, or why. People arrived from many parts of the world after a days-long journey in a freight train, and suddenly the doors opened.
Christine reads from a book written by Selma Leidersdorf, Revolt in Sobibor. The story tells how deportees, completely disoriented, emerge from the carriages.
In Poland, too, we continue to look at the information we find in the old Soviet archives. Even when we read through the automatic computer translation, it is still clear that there is information here that we've not seen in any book about Sobibor.
Such as statements by Soviet soldiers who spoke with Poles who lived in the vicinity of the extermination camps, and that it was beyond any doubt for the local residents that at least Belzec was an extermination camp. The pyres that burned day and night, spreading a horrible stench, made a lot clear to the residents, says Captain Khizilov in one of those statements. What else might we find in the documents from the Soviet archives? It's a lot to read, though, because the website contains hundreds of documents, mainly about Sobibor.
It is difficult to imagine that all those people stood here, next to the overgrown train tracks, that the men and women were separated here, that they had to hand over all their possessions and even their clothes, and that the door of the gas chamber slammed shut behind them before most of them realized what was going to happen. How was it possible that a death machine was operating in Poland? Why, at that time, virtually no one in the Netherlands knew of its existence. How did Sobibor come into being?
After the First World War, the Commander-in-Chief of the German Army, Field Marshal von Hindenburg, told the Commission of Inquiry that Germany lost the war because the army had been weakened by a revolutionary atmosphere in the army and at home. The story went down in history as the myth of the backstabbers. In reality, Germany could no longer win the war militarily. Jews and left-wing parties, among others, were blamed for the defeat and for the peace treaty that had negative consequences for Germany.
Ich habe Hitler gehört, wie im Jahr 1920.
In 1920, Joseph Feller, who later became an SPD politician, witnessed a speech by Hitler in a beer cellar in Munich. He sat at a table with a mug of beer and he listened.
Und da habe ich einen denkbar schlechten Eindruck von ihm, die Versammlung.
The meeting turned into a riot. And Joseph Feller adds, this man should never have been given position in government.
Dieser Mann dürfte nie eine politische Gewalt bekommen.
In 1923, Hitler and a group of his supporters attempted to seize power in Munich through a coup d'etat.
Hitler's press officer Hofstengel. The coup fails and Hitler is sentenced to prison. In prison, he wrote his book Mein Kampf, which outlined his plans for politics, the economy, and the Jews, whom Hitler considered to be the main culprits of much of the misery. When Germany fell into economic crisis, Hitler's support grew. His strongly anti-Semitic ideas were a recurring theme in his speeches.
In uns selbst allein liegt die Zukunft des deutschen Volkes. Wenn wir selbst dieses deutsche Volk.
In 1933, the Nazi Party won the elections with more than a third of the seats. Hitler became the new Reich's Chancellor. In the months that followed, he seized absolute power. The first victims, Hitler's political enemies, socialists and communists, were arrested and placed in newly opened, sometimes even improvised, concentration camps. Jews were increasingly portrayed as scapegoats and anti-Semitism grew. On January the 30, 1939, Hitler said the following in the Reichstag. If financial Jewry, as Hitler calls it, were to plunge the nations into another world war, the result would be the destruction of the Jewish race in Europe.
Later that year, in 1939, Germany invades Poland.
Hitler, who claims on September the 1st, 1939, that the Polish army has fired on German territory. It's a lie. We have been firing back since quarter to six, he adds. The Polish army is no match for the superior forces, and within a few weeks, a large part of Poland is occupied by Germany, what remains in the east by the Soviets.
With 3 million Jewish citizens at that time, the Jewish community in Poland is much larger than that in Germany.
Toen ze Polen binnenvielen en er in één keer 3 miljoen Joden...
This is Alwin Kapitein, Holocaust historian and guide affiliate to the Sobibor Foundation. He describes how inconvenient the presence of Polish Jews was for the Nazi regime. How they all of a sudden had 3 million Jews they considered a problem that they needed to get rid of as soon as possible.
En moesten ze gaan denken, hoe gaan we dit oplossen?
Alwin adds that the solution to their Jew problem was something that presented itself more or less after the invasion of Russia. Hitler found that solution in the Einsatzgruppe, among other things. These were specially trained commandos who traveled behind the troops.
En hun opdracht was op alle ongewenste elementen.
Their mission was to eliminate all undesirable elements in that territory of Russia. At first, they thought of communists, but Jews were often identified with communists. Soon, it was mainly Jews who were murdered.
Maar op de manier waarop dat gebeurde.
But the way in which it was done, namely by shooting all those people in forests or ravines, also caused problems. It was particularly difficult for the people who had to carry it out. They all suffered somehow. Heinrich Himmler himself saw this with his own eyes, and he recognized that another solution had to be found. Apart from that, it was also a waste of bullets, which were, of course, desperately needed in the war. So then they started thinking about another solution, and eventually they came up with the idea of gassing.
Uiteindelijk zijn ze uitgekomen op het idee van vergassen.
There are German doctors and nurses who already have experience with gassing people, says Alwin Kapitein.
Gedurende de zogenaamde Aktion T4 in Duitsland.
Alwin says, during the so-called Aktion T4 in Germany, a euthanasia campaign that took place from October 1939 to August 1941. People with disabilities in the broadest sense, including alcoholics, people with epilepsy, prostitutes and so on, they were all gassed in certain institutions.
Die werden daar in bepaalde instellingen vergast.
And the people who carried this out, who had no objection to gassing people, we will encounter later in Sobibor.
At the end of 1941, construction began on the first of the three extermination camps in the Lublin region, in the easternmost part of the General Government, the Polish territory occupied by Germany. They were called the Aktion Reinhard camps, after Reinhard Heydrich, a high-ranking Nazi who was one of the driving forces behind the persecution of the Jews. The Belzec extermination camp opened in March 1942. Followed by Sobibor and Treblinka. They were among the first camps of the Nazi regime to have gas chambers. Polish Jews were brought there in large groups. Their names were not recorded anywhere.
We will probably therefore never know exactly how many people were ultimately murdered in Sobibor. Lists of Dutch victims have been found, and there are records of who stayed in the Sobibor transit camp in the Netherlands. And at what time, although not all the card indexes have been preserved. The transport lists and card indexes that do remain form the basis for many searches on the fate of Dutch victims. From there, you can search further on, for example, for the trains in which that person was transported, or you could go backwards, from which place of residence did that person ultimately come to Westerbork, and how did that happen? The information, even if it is usually sketchy, is a starting point.
After many years, Richard Oostwal receives a letter from the Red Cross. In it, he reads for the first time about a place called Sobibor, the place where Robbie was murdered.
Toen zeiden ze, die is dan en dan in Sobibor omgekomen.
It hits him hard as he ponders on how someone, anyone, is capable of killing a young boy.
Zo'n jongen kunnen vermoorden.
Richard decides to continue searching for what happened to Robbie after he lost sight of him. How did he meet his end?
Toen wist ik eigenlijk pas.
Information from archives show that Robbie was taken from Amsterdam to Westerbork, the transit camp where he spent a week with his family. A researcher finds Robbie's name there. He finds the barracks where he was housed and the train that took him to Sobibor.
That's when I finally found out what had happened to him, which transport he had been on and on what date. Because I lost him, you see. I lost him in 1942, and I was also terribly angry that he had left without saying goodbye. And that he had been to camp, and so had I. I had also been to a youth camp in Petten to recover a little. I imagine going to a camp like that too. I never knew it was a transit camp, and yes, they also wrote illegal newspapers. They spread the word that Jews are being murdered, but no one believed it. It was so unbelievable. After the war, we were actually waiting for them to come back, but then they didn't.
South of Sobibor, an extermination camp had already been opened in Belzec. Franz Stangl, at that time the commander of Sobibor, told writer Gita Sereni after the war in her book Into That Darkness that he visited Belzec in the summer of 1942. The camp had been in operation for barely 4 months, but according to him, the stench of corpses was everywhere. Thousands of bodies had been buried into mass graves, but the decomposition had pushed the bodies to the surface. In Sobibor too, it later became apparent that burying the victims in this way was not a satisfactory solution, for lack of better words. The stench of the decomposition becomes unbearable in that area too, and the camp's leadership fear of contaminated water increases. After September 42, all the bodies are exhumed.
From that moment on, all the bodies were burned on larger pyres. The glow of the fire could be seen for miles, especially at night. The numbers on the transport lists make this story even more incredible. Because of the thousands of victims arriving every week, the fires must have burned almost continuously, day and night. At the same time, there was a constant smell of burning around the camp.
During the memorial trip to Sobibor, we see fellow travelers repeatedly looking at a hill in the distance on the grounds. It is a few meters high and, like the entire site, large white stones have been placed upon it. It's called the Ash Hill. Richard Oswald finds this place the most impressive of the entire camp. Only then does it sink in how that was possible, because from a distance, it all seems impossible. And then, when you walk down that avenue, with all those stones along the side, you think, how can it be? Such an inhuman idea. When you are there, it finally sinks in. How extensive it was and what it was like. That one human being destroys another. Whether it was a 3-year-old child or an 86-year-old man, their bodies all burned.
After the war, Sobibor was a strange place for a long time, with no buildings left standing. Where the train passengers once had gathered, there was now a museum. Some of the finds from the excavations are on display in display cases throughout the museum. They are the ordinary things that people carried with them: a fork, a toothbrush, pieces of dentures. Objects that are so personal and recognizable that they suddenly connect today's visitors with the victims of that time.
There are a few small name tags that parents put onto children to prevent them from getting lost. Richard, walking past the display cases, suddenly stops in his tracks. Annie Kapper is written on one of the name tags he sees, and he recognizes that name.
Dat was ook zo emotioneel, want ik zag daar een naamplaatje van een meisje die ik gekend heb.
Annie lived in his neighborhood. And he says, there I saw a name tag lying there. She must have worn it.
Annie Kapper was 12 when she arrived in Sobibor. Her father was a music teacher in Amsterdam. We find old newspaper advertisements in which he recruited students. As many of the rights of Jewish citizens were restricted, Annie's father had to close his music school. The family was arrested during a raid and taken to Westerbork, a transit camp in Holland. They are then brought to the gas chambers of Sobibor. Annie, with her name tag still around her neck.
Daar ga je eigenlijk beseffen dat daar een mens mee gezeten heeft.
Only then you realize that a human being was sitting here. Normally you say, yes, so-and-so was gassed there and there, and that is a bit abstract, but now it becomes reality, and that reality really moves me.
Nathan Schijvenschuurder, 35 jaar. Rachel Schijvenschuurder, 6 jaar. Branka Schijvenschuurder Schelvis, 36 jaar.
According to Jewish tradition, there are two moments when you die. The first time when your heart stops beating, and the second time when your name is spoken for the last time. When no one mentions your name anymore, then you are truly dead.
That is why every 5 years, the list of 102,000 names of all the people who were transported from Westerbork to Auschwitz, Sobibor and other places is read aloud at Westerbork Memorial Center. Richard is there this year. Just before he reads a part of the list himself, the names of the family he lost during the war are read out loud. Robbie's family.
Salomon Slachter, 10 jaar. Samuel Slachter.
Door die namen die net voor mij waren, was ik een beetje emotioneel.
Richard says, because of the names that came just before mine, I was a little emotional, but I had prepared myself well.
Joseph Slap, 40 jaar. Maar ja, ik had er eentje bij van 1 jaar. Hè.
Richard was emotional during the reading of the names, particularly as he also read the name of a 1-year-old child. Who is capable of murdering a 1-year-old child, he says.
Wie vermoord nou een kind van 1 jaar?
A Guilty Place is the title of this episode. The idea that a place itself is partly to blame for what happened comes from the Dutch artist Armando. He created a series of artworks entitled Guilty Landscape, full of angry strokes. As a boy, Armando played in the woods around Camp Amersfoort, a transit camp where prisoners were abused and murdered. In Armando's view, the trees surrounding the camps are also guilty. The trees that were later planted in Sobibor, for example, contributed to the near erasure of history. The landscape has done evil, he wrote. Everything grows again, but much has been forgotten. To forget is to betray.
Thomas Blatz was one of the people who managed to escape from Sobibor during the uprising. Thomas wrote down his experiences and had a survivor of Auschwitz read them. After reading it, the survivor said, "You have a large imagination." He had never heard of Sobibor. The whole story was so unknown that even he, being a Holocaust survivor, could not believe the account.
In the next episode, you will hear more about the excavations at the camp and the sensational discovery made by archaeologists in Sobibor.
De belangrijkste ontdekking zijn de fundamenten van de gaskamers.
The most important discoveries are the foundations of the gas chamber and the road along which people were forced to walk to the gas chambers. And we will learn more about the content of the documents from the Soviet archives. If you don't want to miss out on it, click on follow or subscribe right now. We are Audiodrome Podcast Productions, and we are producing this series in collaboration with the Sobibor Foundation in the Netherlands.
Someone said, you shouldn't write poems about Sobibor because the language of poetry is too elegant for what happened there. And maybe that person is right, but we're going to try anyway. Every episode of this podcast series ends with Ben Oranje. He writes poems, or spoken word if you like. And just like you, he listened to the episode. This is what he heard and what he thought about. A poem for Sobibor, perhaps against better judgment.
Nature conceals. It is a witness every day. These are the darkest of seasons. But the world stays unfaced. The first train arrived in March, but in me a fury takes hold. For trees carrying barbed wire that only now unfold. They stall, grow their ivies against the wall. Where were they when they burned all their roots and drenched their wells? Trees reaching heaven but witnessing hell. The guilt, it hides in the grass. It never let in light when it was always this dark. Amongst the trees, beings of fear, monsters of no human kind. Amongst the trees are fires burning day and night, whispering forest, secrets ignite. If there are people left in this place, let there be no more rain, no more deceit, no more pain. Grant them the softest of days. Let deers run freely, let them eat out of children's hand. Salomon and Annie, your names will forever stand.